Here, there's a lot of nature around here. It may be a tree, a flower, the sky, or it may be something man-made, whatever it is. But nature particularly is helpful in this practice at first. You notice the first moment of looking at something, there's always a space of no thought. It may be 1 second. It may be 2 seconds. Now, most human beings are not aware of that. And with some human beings, the space of no thought is so brief that they can't capture it because immediately thought comes in after half a second. But there was half a second. There's always a space before thought can come in. There is a looking, a seeing. And in with you, that space will now become larger. And in many of you, it is already quite spacious. In other words, the spaciousness around your sense perceptions. So notice that it is already there, but as you become aware of it, the spaciousness grows around your sense perceptions. So, and now comes, this is a magnificent thing, it's a great mystery that in past ages people had to spend 25 years in a monastery to be told this. The master would say, okay, you work with me for 20 years and then ask me again that question. But now things are speeding up. We haven't got that much time. In a good sense, on the planet, we are running out of time, and that's wonderful. It's shrinking. So when you see something, there's a sense perception. Can you be aware both of what arises in your sense perception, what you're looking at, or it may be listening? And can you be aware of the awareness, which is the stillness, in which that sense perception happens? And that stillness, that awareness is, one could say, the space around it. So there is a spacious field and there's a sense perception, and you are not interpreting what you see for a while. There's no need. There's a deep knowing, but there's no interpretation. There's not conceptual knowing. Not that you've lost your ability to have concepts, but when you need them, they'll be there. Words, concepts, thoughts. But you are no longer compulsively trapped in concepts. You are exiting a conceptualized reality. Oh, that is the awakening. You are stepping out of inhabiting a totally conceptualized universe, which is mental conditioning. Everything is called something, interpreted, labeled, named. And so a great freedom arises of perceiving through the unconditioned consciousness, and this is, you are here to experience that and to see that it is already, that movement is already happening in you, that freeing yourself from compulsive conceptualization is already happening. And it is happening when you look at a tree or a flower or another human being, and it enters your field of vision, and in that moment there's pure perception and no labeling it in any way. Just a field of stillness. And it may be that it's only there for a few seconds. But see if you can capture that space. And that's a, not perhaps a very good way of saying it, because you cannot capture stillness. It's see if you can be attentive and see if you can notice that. And that noticing is vital, because as you notice the stillness in which your perception happens, the space or the stillness expands. So as you perceive things, you are now inhabiting two dimensions. One is the dimension of form, which is all around you, continuously fluctuating. And they may be outer forms or they may be inner forms, as emotions, thoughts. And the other dimension is the dimension of the formless consciousness, pure consciousness, pure awareness. The other is the dimension of the object consciousness, things. So you inhabit the dimension of the manifested without being lost in it. Because you also dwell in the unmanifested. You dwell in the realm of stillness. And even if at first the spaces of stillness don't last for very long, it's good enough. 3 seconds of looking at a flower with no thought is good enough. And as you become aware of there's not only the flower, I'm naming it now, but the awareness is not the naming. You become aware of the flower and you become aware of the field of awareness or the stillness. And this looks like a dualistic thing, but it isn't. It only becomes dualistic when we speak about it. When you speak about becoming aware of awareness, it looks like two things. Aware of awareness. But that's only because of we are using language which has a subject and an object in a sentence. What is really happening is self-awareness. You're becoming aware. Awareness is becoming aware of itself. So that is the dimension, and you can. It's hard to talk about that. And in a way, the author of the Tao Te Ching is right when he says at the beginning of this book of wisdom, the Tao Te Ching, if you can speak about it, that's not it. So it's not, the words have to be seen as for what they are, just pointers. So this is a beautiful practice here. Walk around wherever you are, sit, stand, lie, walk. Be aware of yourself as the aware presence, as the stillness in which everything is seen and heard. And so you become like a little child. It's not for nothing that Jesus said, you must become as little children if you want to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now what he is pointing to, and he's not saying exactly that, it's always just an approximation. It does not mean you return to that state, because there's only that quality that a little child has in whom the conceptual reality has not yet developed. And when that little child in whom the accumulation of words and concepts in the mind has not happened yet, that little child looks at the universe, and you sometimes can see it when you see a 1-year-old, 1.5, before language takes possession of their minds, the way they look is thoughtless awareness. and then they smile at you, there's the pure joy of being. And you can see that that which shines through is magnificent. And then gradually the veil descends, because the child is programmed to ask, the mind of the child is programmed to ask, "Daddy, what's that?" And then Daddy says, "That's a tree." And then the mind says, "Tree, tree, that's tree." Next time the child sees a tree, that open, complete openness is no longer quite as open, because then the child looks at the tree and then the mind says, "Oh, tree." And 2 years, 3 years later, the mind is already possessed with concepts. So when Jesus says that, it's pointing, as little children, you walk around in that state of openness, of non-labeling, the state of original innocence, which replaces the dysfunction, the collective dysfunction of the human mind that we could call original sin, if we go beyond the habitual interpretations of sin. There's no doubt that there's a dysfunction in humanity. Look at human history. That's why they talk of original sin. It means sin means missing the target. If you, the original Greek word translated means missing the target. That's what sin means in the original. And in other words, you miss the point of your whole existence. And if you miss the point of your whole existence, you suffer. And that eventually works too. It wakes you up eventually. So it seems insignificant at first to the human mind to say you can look at something and notice whenever you first look at something that there's a moment of spacious presence before the mind comes in and calls it something. And if that can be sustained, not through effort, not through wanting, not through some kind of act of willpower, but if that can be sustained simply by noticing that space of aware presence when it arises, and then even as a human being comes into your field of vision, walks in through the door, appears in front of you, you look, and there's a moment of non-labeling. Let's say it's somebody you have never met before comes, and you look, and there's not a single thought in your head for perhaps 5 seconds. But if you notice that in the first moment there's just there's a field of awareness in which the perception happens before the labeling comes in, you may find that it expands. And you could still be in the state of just looking a minute later. And you can even talk. And every time a sentence has come to an end, you re-enter the state of spacious awareness. A word has been uttered, and you're back in space. And then your words have a different quality too, because now they come out of that dimension. They have an aliveness. They will touch the other human being. What you say has the essence of that freshness of being. Not the old stuff that otherwise is your mind. You're telling them, a minute later after meeting a person, you tell them the old story of me. So what do you do for a living? Well, blah, 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 blah. You can talk about that also and then step back knowing that's not who you are. So who are you? You are the stillness. That's where your true sense of I am comes from, of beingness. So this is the opportunity as you sit here to be in that state. You don't really need to think as you sit here. I certainly don't think as I speak. The words are heard as they come out of the mouth. I hear them, as you do. So there's nobody teaching anybody. Do I know more than you? No, of course not. Probably less than most of you. What I know is the realm of stillness. And that's not anybody's personal achievement, because everybody has that as their essence. So what I know is your essence. That's why it's nice to sit with me, because otherwise, why would anybody come? What you enjoy most is to be with yourself, but in the true sense, not the mind-made self, the deepest self. Now, ultimately, you don't have to go anywhere. This is just a temporary stage in the evolution of humanity where you have to travel somewhere to be with yourself. Now, some of you have traveled to India, and perhaps you already know you don't have to go to India, and so Omega is a little closer. And the next stage is you don't have to go to Omega. You may go for the enjoyment. I sometimes enjoy listening to spiritual teachers who may be using different words, and yet the truth is there, and it's a wonderful, deep joy in hearing it in a slightly different form. When you meet a human being and don't label them, or if that is not yet possible, at least not for more than a few seconds, and then compulsive labels come into your mind, what you can do, however, is to recognize the labels that come into your mind as just that, without believing in them completely. Because the mind is the compulsion to interpret everybody and everything. It does that to other human beings. You form judgments. You meet them and you look at them. And the more you're identified with your mind, the quicker you are in your judgments of the other human being. You know them exactly. On what it might even be true occasionally. You may have seen something that's actually there, but what you have seen and thought that this person is some conditioning in the other person, not who that person is. Or you have completely imposed your own conditioned perception on that person. But you can recognize any thought you have about a human being as just a thought and a perspective and one of many possible thoughts and not the ultimate truth. So you recognize the relativity of your thinking. The relativity of your thinking. There's one spiritual teaching that works entirely with that. It's a particular, Byron Katie has this teaching that whatever thought comes into your head about another person, about yourself, or about your situation, you look at the thought and you ask yourself, can I really know that this is so? Can I really know that this is true? And if you really look at the thought and you say, I can't really know that this is true, this thought that I have about this person or this situation. So it's a stepping, a continuous letting go of identification with thought. And then gradually the compulsive thoughts arise less and less. And as the compulsive thoughts arise less and less, more space is there. That's why we are here, for the arising of space, stillness. And in many of you, it's already happening as you sit there. But there are some, I can see or sense, a few, not many, fields of restless energy here and there. Or other skull. You may want to try feeling your hands as you sit here, because you are restless, because your entire attention is still lodged in the head, in the mind. And the mind must feel either restless or anxious or totally bored sitting here. So if you cannot get out of that, the body really is the... If you can simply begin by feeling the inner energy field in your hands, and that there is, yes, there is an aliveness there, you can feel that there is a hand, not externally, but internally. If you closed your eyes and somebody asked you, is your left hand still there? For a moment, you would have to internally, so to speak, look for it. And then you would say, you would feel something. You say, yeah. And then the question is, how do you know that it's still there? Because it's not touching anything, you're not moving it. And then, of course, you will know, because I can feel it. I can feel its energy. That's how I know that the left hand is still there. Not a memory that it was there when I last looked. And then your answer comes from the memory. Yeah, it's still there. I saw it a minute ago. And again, these things to the mind seem insignificant, but they are of tremendous significance. To begin to inhabit the body, which takes you out of inhabiting the mind exclusively. If you can feel your left hand or your right hand, you can also feel other parts of the body. You have to just start somewhere that becomes the entry point into the body. I'm speaking particularly to those, to all of you, but to those who are either bored out of their minds. Well, if you were bored out of your mind, you would be okay. But those who are still bored in their minds, or are feeling restless and are thereby missing the essence of what of this gathering. Get into your body. Get in there. Feel the legs, the feet, the hands, the arms. So what if you can feel one hand, you can feel the other hand simultaneously. You feel them both at the same time. The feeling of hand. Feet. You can feel both feet also as you feel your hands. Subtle at first. Some people feel almost like a tingling sensation. But some people feel a warmth. And then can you feel the trunk of your body, the belly? Sometimes to feel the belly is very helpful to be in there. Taking one deep breath or two or three deep breaths and following the breath with your attention and feel the belly or the abdomen is the more polite word. Feel the abdomen rising as you breathe in into the belly. And for a moment, there's a cessation. The belly is full and then breathe out. So breathing a few times into the deep, take the belly breath, which means you have to follow. It's not just a practice, an external practice. The essence here is that you follow the breath with your attention and then you move into the belly. So the attention leaves the head and moves into the body. So you breathe into the belly. And there you could say you're in, this is the center of the body. Around here, solar plexus also, but belly is a beautiful center. And once you've breathed in a few times into the belly, you can actually feel the energy field of the belly here, and you rest there. And from there radiates out energy into the rest of the body. Hara, the center, as the Japanese call it. So here, and you may notice then, when you look at not only the images of the Chinese fat Buddha with a huge belly, who laughs all the time because he has no problems left, toothless old man with a huge belly, who, whatever you say to him, come with your problems, he will laugh at you. But you may also notice that the Indian Buddhas and other Southeast Asian Buddhas, most of them have a very slight protrusion in the belly region. So there's the belly, there's a little bit of just slight, because they rest here. Their center of gravity is not in the head, as it is with modern humans, Western especially, but the whole world has become Western. So the center of gravity is not in the head. The center of gravity is in the center of your physically perceived body, but it goes beyond body. So you rest there. And so to sense this, the that field of aliveness is beautiful. It takes you out of the head. Your attention moves down here. You unite with the all-pervasive intelligence that is beyond the mind that inhabits your body, that is only an expression of the one intelligence. It's the intelligence that lives in your body as the life energy that regulates thousands of complicated functions, complicated from the point of view of the human mind, that regulates, coordinates thousands of functions in the body simultaneously to everything is just right. If, well, one thing slightly maladjusted, the body would die immediately.
You would collapse. Temperature, heart rate, lungs, circulation, innumerable things that you could spend the next 5,000 years analyzing how the human body works, and you still wouldn't get to the end of it. And that's only the outer body. So there's an intelligence at work that is vast. So if you can feel your body, that is an entry point into that vastness. And the deeper you go, if you do it for yourself, you can do it with your eyes closed at first, so that you become familiar with inhabiting the body, and realize as you go deeper that it's not really about the body. It's about sensing that vast spaciousness that is here. Vast spaciousness. So you enter the spaciousness through the body. And then everything comes to life. Once your body comes to life, and then you look around and open your eyes without losing the inner sense of body, then you feel everything is more alive suddenly. It participates in that because you are not deadening it anymore with mental abstractions, concepts, labels. It has always been alive. You couldn't see it anymore, couldn't feel it anymore, sense it anymore. So if I recommend that each one of you spend some time going into nature and being perhaps with choose something like a tree or flower or patch of ground or a landscape, maybe the lake, the little lake we have here, whatever, or a rock with moss growing on the rock. There's some trails here, beautiful moss growing over ancient rocks. And just be there, be with it, and as you look, feel the energy field of the inner body at the same time. That makes it much easier to look without mental interference, to have a space of stillness as you look. So you're present within and without, and you look from there. The inner body becomes a root, that which roots you in the present moment, anchors you in the present moment, and takes you out of mind. And if then mind starts working again, anything, if you are doing anything creative in your life, become still first. Before the act of creation, there needs to be stillness. Nothing creative can come out of the accumulations of the mind. The mind can be an instrument to give something form, but the inspiration, the creative impulse, comes from a deeper level. It comes from the stillness, the presence. So go into the body and feel that. You don't need to think anymore there. And then you look, and then at some point a thought comes or a creative movement comes. It may be dance, whatever. It may be a word that you speak, words that come out of your mouth, but they come out of the stillness. So getting in touch with that is a simple and beautiful way of entering the realm of no thought. And then thought can operate beautifully and is not going to create problems as it usually does. Because most of your life problems are created by thought. Life only has challenges. The only place where a challenge can come is in the now. Apart from a challenge that comes in the now,
there is no problem except in the head. The power to face challenges is always there in the now. But you cannot face problems because they have no reality. Always use as the criterion to tell you whether your problems are real, ask, what's the problem at this moment? What can I do about it now? Nothing. I'm lying in bed. It's 4 a.m. Then go into the body. Okay. Ah, it feels good to be alive. And I thought I had problems. At 9 o'clock in the morning, when you enter the office, you open the door, and there sits this man who you were thinking about all night, who is creating problems for you, and his mouth opens, words come out of his mouth, and you bring an alert, aware presence to it, and you look and listen, and then words come out of your mouth. They won't be reactive anymore. They will be a response, not an old reaction. Then the words will be true. They will be just right for that moment. And they're not rehearsed. Or no words come. You may look at him and walk out. Who knows? Nobody can predict. Right action. Buddhism sometimes talks of right action, right speech, right this, right that. I've forgotten the list. I can't remember things. But those things, they come out of right presence. You have to be present. You cannot, otherwise you cannot manufacture or try to bring about right words, right speech, right actions. Okay, I'm trying very hard here to say the right thing. I'm trying hard to do the right thing. It's not working. You can't try to do the right, because the right thing comes out of a particular state of consciousness. Spontaneity, intuition, realization comes out of stillness. So in this shift, thinking loses its capacity to make you unhappy. Thoughts for a while still arise, but they're not that overpowering anymore. You're not totally in them anymore. And then space arises. The ability to not think arises when there is nothing much to think about, when life would be far more joyful if we are not interpreting this moment. And if you live in alignment with this moment, a lot of the time, you're better off not interpreting this moment. Let it be. It is. And out of that state, necessary action comes. Or doesn't. If it's not necessary, it doesn't. So the revolutionary shift, the evolutionary and revolutionary shift in humans, in human consciousness, is to enter that dimension where compulsive thinking comes to an end. compulsive thinking comes to an end. To transcend thought and realize that you are more fully yourself and more intelligent when you are not thinking. And when thought then comes in, should it be needed, it will be more effective, more powerful, more creative. So you are here to be able to learn to enter that realm of, this is the realm of great power, the realm of pure awareness. And it's not just the words that are pointing to it here. As you sit, it arises because there is that realm itself is here in the energy field of this gathering. And it is very helpful, even if your mind is saying, okay, I'm not really getting this. Of course it's not really getting it. The mind cannot get the essence of it. So the most helpful thing about this gathering is the energy field of stillness or presence that works, comes from within you, but is also here in this field. That's the essence, and that's what works most powerfully, that transforms you. The words are additional helps, additional pointers. And also to keep you entertained while you sit there in the energy field. So practice again is the wrong word because it implies some kind of effort almost, but it is effortless, pure seeing, pure listening, become aware. Whenever you look at something, at first there is a space before thinking happens. As you become aware of the space, you may find that it expands. What that means in relationship to other humans, we will look at. If you can relate to other human beings, what it does to human relationships. I suggest, just for a little while, you stay here when this body has moved away. Just stay until you feel the impulse to get up. Just stay for a little while in this energy field, in the stillness, and see that the body on this chair here is not really needed. That's enough, what's there. Thank you.
This concludes Lesson 2. Lesson 3, Using Sound as a Portal into Stillness.
Like this, maybe you'd rather be somewhere else. If the weather weren't so wonderful, I would be happy to be here in this now, but it's so nice out there. There was a Zen master walking with one of his disciples out in the country, and they sat down under a tree. And the disciple didn't quite get it yet, what Zen is. He'd only been there for 6 years. So the master was sitting there just being, watching, listening. And the disciple was thinking. And then he said, Master, I've been thinking, how do I enter Zen? The question means, how do I enter the state of consciousness that is Zen? And there was a long silence before the master said anything. And then the master raised his finger and said, can you hear the sound of that mountain stream? And the disciple said, he at first couldn't hear anything, and then yes, I can hear it. Suddenly he heard the distant mountain stream. Yeah. And Master said, enter Zen from there. Oh. Okay. And for just a little while the disciple was there, attentive, alert, listening. And then, a few minutes later, the face of the disciple changed again from the openness to, Master, I've been thinking, now what if I had said, no, I can't hear the mountain stream? What would you have said then? And the master raised his finger again and said, disciple, yes, enter Zen from there. So it's the mountain stream is beautiful. More beautiful and deeper is the state of consciousness. If he hadn't heard the mountain stream, it would have been the same. He would have been in the state of alert attention and might have said, I can hear nothing. And the master says, enter Zen from there. So here, I take this as a little signpost, teaching story for you also to work with sound here, because there are beautiful sounds here in this place, and to be attentive to the sounds that you hear. Today, I will remind you again tomorrow when we may spend the day in silence, particularly good opportunity to be attentive to the many subtle sounds that you hear here, from the crunching of gravel or little stones as you walk, to crickets, the frogs, the leaves and the moving in the wind, many sounds that are beautiful and subtle. To hear them requires a certain degree of alertness. That's why Zen masters often raise their finger. That symbolizes not, I'm telling you, you better believe me. No, not that. It says, be alert, awake. So that's the state is required. So when you listen to a sound, you place a field of attention that is actually more important than the sound, no matter how beautiful the sound is. But the sound can draw your attention out. And then you learn to not just listen, hear the sound and then immediately label it and then are done with it, but stay a while and remain attentive to that sound, or it might be a sequence of sounds, if it's crickets or birds. Be attentive and remain there and let the sound be there. So, and then you have what we mentioned this morning when you, with reference to the visual, where you have the sense perception, the visual sense perception happens against the background of stillness. And now also the auditory sense perception happens also in the field of stillness or against the background of stillness. So to every sense perception, there is a background. We could also call it the ground. In ordinary consciousness, humans are not aware of the ground, which is awareness, the background, the entire substratum, to use a term from geology. So as you listen to the sound, which is in the foreground of your consciousness, you're also aware of the background. And the background is very hard to describe in any way because it is not something. The sound is something. And as it is something, it is born and eventually it dies. The background is not born and dies. It's always there, unchanging. So you are lost in a surface world of external appearances and things when you do not know that dimension, the background dimension, that could also be called the unmanifested. But I'm using a somewhat different pointer, just to some pointers can be more helpful to certain people. So there is the background, and to see that as you sit, stand, lie, you listen, there's the sound. Do I have a bell here? It dissolved. I wanted to demonstrate how a sound comes into being and then goes out of existence, slowly fades out. But we have something even better. The entire bell has faded out of existence. So to be aware of that is amazing, the One can also call it a field of peace that underlies your perceptions. A background peace. And imagine having that background peace in human interactions. How that changes everything between human beings. Let's put that aside for a moment and stay with just the sounds. It's a little easier. Humans are complicated. And you will notice that when you fall back into the dream state of being identified with the stream of thinking, all the subtle sounds around you, you don't even notice. You don't hear them. Your attention is elsewhere. Your attention, your consciousness, is being absorbed by thought continuously. There isn't much left for anything else. There isn't also much left for creativity or anything new to come in. It's all repetitive. And so here, you are making space inside you for there's no other way for something truly new to arise in your life, something truly that comes out of this, the freshness of the unmanifested, the freshness of being itself, and takes on form, a thought, a word, an action, some creation, perhaps a work of art, a work of this or that, or simply a way of being with others that has a different quality than the normal way of being with others. So that's the only way something truly new can come in. Because no matter how your life changes on the surface, it's not a true change. You could, if your bank account is empty now and you win $10 million, on the external level, things will change. But that's not very much. The same set of problems that you have now, or very similar one, will arise again. The fear of not enough is not going to go away, perhaps for a few weeks. And again, it might become magnified because you have a bigger scenario for you to play out your drama. And if you're rich and famous, then they can write about you and your drama. That's all. And it looks bigger, but it's just like everybody else's. It's just when the drama is played out between the two famous actors in a mansion, it looks interesting. It's not interesting at all. It's the same drama that happens everywhere else, and there's nothing new. It's repetitive. And then they get a divorce and marry somebody else, and it starts again. So for something truly new to arise, you need to find, not create as such, because it's already there, you need to find, one could say, that dimension of space. One could say you have to make space, yes. In one way, that's the space already wants to come through, the spatial consciousness. In another, one could say it requires your cooperation. You have to make room. Then it's a beautiful, more harmonious emergence. If it pushes, it wants to come through and there's a heavy egoic structure, it may still come through, but it has to create havoc in your life first because the shell has to break. And then you're struck by some disaster that breaks the shell of ego, whatever it may be. And so there are people here who have already experienced some kind of disaster in their lives, some great loss, where their life is threatened or where everything collapsed. and something began to come through that. Otherwise, there was no space there, because there was all the mind objects that one had identified with as oneself covering up the vastness, the infinite possibilities, the infinite potential that is there in the unmanifested, in the background, in the space consciousness. So these are beautiful pointers that there is in you object consciousness, which is thought, which is mental images. Anything that has form is object consciousness. For most humans, all they ever experience in their life is object consciousness. Their entire life experience consists of a succession of arising and subsiding objects. And they try to hang on to a bundle of mental objects that they think, that's me. Mental images, names, labels, what they think of me, or has been taught to think of who they are. But what are all these things? They are thought forms that you hang on to, and you put some, you wrap it with something, cling wrap, whatever, that holds it together. A very fragile structure. And that's me. And it consists of mental objects, many of which are the mental counterpart of material objects or material achievements. So there's the shiny, new, flashy car, which in itself is, of course, is not important because it's going to rust in a few years, it'll be gone. And all it can do is take you from A to B. It's nice, yes, we can appreciate these things. But if they become an object, then a mental form arises, which is not just car, it's my car. My is the important thing, because then the thought object of car becomes invested with a sense of self. It's not just a car. I relate to it. I'm looking for myself in it. So the mind object, the thought object, car, becomes very important to me. And if somebody scratches your car or even dents it accidentally, it feels, if you identify with that as my car, it feels you are being injured personally. And anger arises because somebody is attacking you. Or let them say that somebody says, well, this may be a nice car, but my uncle has one that's much bigger than yours. Can't be. And you feel diminished in your sense of self. That's how people play their ego games. One little ego tries to diminish another little ego by claiming that my uncle has something bigger than you. I don't have it, but it's enough. It's my uncle. So there's some association. Because it's my... So it's an indirect thing that I can identify with. Of course it's absurd and funny, but a lot of human interaction works in that way. And so you identify with what on, you may then identify with other things that are a little bit more subtle. Other people's opinion of you, which becomes also a mind, a mental image. Knowledge, acquired knowledge. A certain skill that you have. You may be extremely good at hitting a ball. And it's a great thing. If you are a master at hitting a ball one way or another, then probably in that field of activity, if you are truly a master, you are probably present, at least during that time when you're hitting that ball, when you're playing the game, when you're in the zone, you're not thinking, you're not planning, there's no decision-making. Right action happens every moment, and there's a power, and then people love to watch you. But then what happens when you stop playing the game? You re-enter the normal state of consciousness. And then you identify with that skill. It becomes a mind object. You are better at it than anybody else. And the world is telling you that. So that is something also. And then somebody else suddenly comes who is even better than you, and they chuck you out. You're no longer captain of the team or whatever it is. Oh, no. And that's very painful when a mind object, something you had identified with, is taken away, dissolves. Great loss, great pain. So most humans only know themselves as objects, object in the realm of object consciousness. Such a pity when there is so much more to human life. There's an entire realm that's always been there and humans just haven't looked at it. They've been so seduced by the world of objects, both the external objects in their world as well as the inner objects in their mind. They've been so seduced by the world of objects, so fascinated by objects, so completely identified with the things of this world, that they forgot that there is an entirely different other dimension to their being than that, which has never gone away. The great thing is that you cannot destroy space consciousness. You can ignore it. You cannot know that it's there underneath the accumulated object consciousness. Yes, but it is there. You cannot even in the most obsessed person, obsessed with thinking, and not, you see, it's not a moment of continuously one next thing and the next thing, one damn thing after another. Churchill's definition of history, one damn thing after another. But we could also define the human mind as that. It comes one thing after another. And never aware that there is this vast realm within them that would free them from dependency on the world of things, which includes their mind, because it's objects, object consciousness. That vast realm is there and they never know it. It's like the example of like a beggar sitting, trying to get a few cents from someone who's going to give, and he's been sitting on a box filled with gold. I gave that example at the beginning of the book. He's been sitting on this box filled with gold, but he's never looked. He's only looked out there. Or we could say a more modern version of that. He's been sitting there and never realized that he has a bank account in Switzerland, and that has $100 million in it, and he wants. Now, this is a somewhat deficient parable, because even if somebody truly, if the beggar had a bank account in Switzerland with $1 million in it, wouldn't really make that much difference to his life, because it's so much deeper than that. But it's a parable for people who can think. You've already gone beyond it, but I put it at the beginning of the book, because most people know only the realm of objects. So a box full of gold works as a metaphor for a while, but it's not ultimately the right metaphor, because it's so much greater than any entire gold in the world. And so that's that space consciousness is in you, has never gone away, but been ignored. The peace, the stillness. And I'm presenting here, apart from the fact, which is more important, that as we sit here, it arises from within you, even if you didn't want it. But I'm also pointing out little entry points into it. We've already seen bringing a yes to the present moment is an entry point when you accept the form. Form is a thing, is an object. When you accept the form that this moment takes as something that happens, or an inner form, an emotion that arises, when you do not resist the form that arises, and the normal state of consciousness is almost continuous denial or resistance of the form, because you want another one in the next moment, a better one, a different one, a more fulfilling one, not this form of the present moment, I want a different form. Or if I don't have it, at least I can think about it, so I don't have to look at this. I imagine the next moment is going to be better than this one. It won't if you haven't fully acknowledged this one. So, when you accept the form that this moment takes, that is the miracle. The form of this moment becomes an opening into the formless within you. And the worse, the more challenging the form that this moment is, and you accept it, the deeper it takes you into the unconditioned space consciousness or into peace. So if you were faced with a dreadful disaster in your life, it arises at this moment. Everything has collapsed. And you face it and see that the isness of this moment just is as it is. You look death in the face. You accept the form that this moment takes completely. And suddenly, you sense something that cannot really be described. It's a spaciousness or peace around that dreadful event. It happens within a field of peace or space. And I wouldn't use here the word happy. You're not happy when that happens, nor are you unhappy. It is beyond happiness and unhappiness. There's a serenity and a peace that come. But you can experience even with little things. Surrender to a little thing, a little form that this moment takes, a little challenge, and you find a little peace. Oh, nice. You surrender to the cold soup that I mentioned yesterday. And you find that the cold soup is giving you a little peace. It's not the soup. It's changed your state of consciousness. It's gone, oh, okay. You make room for it to happen. You allow it to happen. You make space for it to happen. Humans don't make space for things to happen. They want to remove space from things. So now if something is happening and you make space for it, you become the space. So, and this is the grace that is hidden underneath so-called bad events. Now, bad events have a scale of, they start with a cold soup, very little, and go on to some dreadful accident, disaster, imminent death, or everybody around you died, or you lost everything, or somebody tells you you only have 3 more weeks to live. You have the scale, something dreadful, something so-called bad happens in your life. And then there's a scale. Cold soup is easy. But for some, that's a challenge too. And so for some, it sets the whole pattern. They have a cold soup and the rest of the day is spoiled. They don't make room for events. They don't allow an event to be. They argue with reality. I saw a cartoon once. It's hard to describe, but I'll attempt it. It showed people wearing placards. It's come some kind of protest march. And the placards contained only horizontal lines. And the entire surroundings, the street and the houses, were drawn in vertical lines. So the message is, we are against it. Whatever it is, we are against it. So if you make room for something to be, it can only be this moment because nothing can be apart from the now. You make room for something to be, it already is, so why not allow it? Allow it to be. And this act of allowing, easy to do when you face something beautiful. I allow this beautiful tree with the magnificent colors to be. That's easy. And then you walk one more step and suddenly you sink, your right foot goes right into the mud. Crunch. And there comes a minor challenge. Can you immediately say, oh, it already has happened. It is already. Not much you can do except, of course, pull your foot out and walk on. But usually, of course, it would lead to a reaction. So some words may then come out of your mouth. Contraction happens. And maybe there could be an immediate attempt to blame someone. This is what the ego likes to do. Something goes wrong, okay, who can I blame, it says the ego. They should have warned people about this. Or if you are in the States, then the favorite thing is go to a lawyer and sue them. So, and this is a beautiful practice, the many things that, in quotation marks, go wrong in your life are actually the greatest things. In a way, even greater than the beautiful trees, because they can take you deeper. And so, to a large extent, the world is here for you to experience things going wrong. And that is the challenge of the world. And if you still think otherwise, you may have lived on this planet for 50, 60 or 70 years and still expect things not to go wrong.
Lesson 3, continued on Disc 4.